This is Arthur Martin, recorded at his home in Eastleigh in Hampshire on the 28th of June 2010 by Chris Eldon Lee. Arthur Martin, Part 1.
Arthur Martin, I was born in Bedford on the 4th of December 1925.
So you're 84?
Coming on 85, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me a bit about your childhood, because it was rather an irregular one, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was, really. Unfortunately, I never knew my father. He died about 4 months before I was born. I was then brought up by foster parents, because my mother had to work in order to keep me as a child. And that went on, although I saw my mother from time to time. She was a professional cook in a very large house in Bedford. And we had a house in Bedford, a delightful house. And occasionally, at a weekend, I would spend with her. And then when I was nine, she died. And that really changed life again, because my father's brother was almost allocated to take me over, as it were. And I went to Cambridge from there. And then spent a number of years with my aunt and uncle. And I suppose 37 really was the next stage when I began a new school in Cambridge. And the first morning of my new school, my housemaster or teacher said, "You look to me as if you should be a scout." He said, "We're meeting tonight. You're coming, aren't you?" And really that began another chapter of my life.
The main chapter?
Well, the main chapter, as it was, yes. And so I became a member of the 13th Cambridge, which today, or this year, celebrates its centenary. And that was a great step forward for the group.
Did you find you took to scouting naturally?
I think so, yes, because I had no brothers or sisters. I mean, I had no family as such in there. And there I found fellowship and good companionship, with lots of activities that I enjoyed. And, of course, then I progressed through the patrol, as it were, to become a second, a patrol leader, and then a troop leader, until the war took me away. And during the early part of the war, of course, we were left, really, in the troop with no leaders at all. They'd all been called up and all gone. So the boys ran the thing. And the district commissioner occasionally came to have a look at us and pat us on their back and said, "You're doing a good job." And he said, on one occasion, he said, "You're doing very well," he said, "keeping things going. But what are you doing about yourselves?" It was a group, four of us, you see. And we said, we're keeping the ship going, as it were. He said, "No, what are you doing yourselves to develop?" So after he landed that little seed with us, we sat down and said, "Well, what are we going to do?" And they said, "Oh, well, let's be first-class scouts, and then let's be King Scouts." And that set us two projects. And within, I suppose, 2 years, we'd achieved that as well, keeping the troop and the pack going. We became King Scouts, the six of us all together at the one time. And that was a great achievement for the group.
This involved passing some sort of test?
Yes, it was gaining public service badges, such as the fireman, the ambulance badge, and the pathfinder, and several other useful badges which the community could use. And that, in a way, I suppose, set a pattern for the rest of my life again, because these days a Queen Scout is a recognition for young people having achieved that stage, along with the gold Edinburgh's award. And it certainly helped me in the Navy.
Well, I was going to say, I presume, apart from gaining these accolades, there's also a certain amount of absorbing of structure and discipline and organisational skills going on as
well. Oh, yes, yes. I suppose leadership was constantly with us because we had youngsters to lead and promote in the programme of the troop. And that carried on. And those public service badges really cropped up in life as it went along. And when you come to LaCroix, I will explain how one actually did and what a surprise it was. But and the cook's badge too, you see.
Very useful in the
Very sense. Useful it was, absolutely. Yes.
So you found yourself being elevated into the Navy in 1944?
Well, yes, on His Majesty's request. like others, yes. Yeah. I went to HMS Royal Arthur, which was Butler in Skegness holiday camp. Spent about 6 weeks there, I suppose, doing tests and kitting out. And then to HMS Duke in Great Malvern, where was square bashing and lots of dental treatment. And eventually to Portsmouth for a spot of training there, and then to a transit camp while the doodlebugs were flying over Portsmouth and dropping to join a ship to Southeast Asia. All happened in 1944, and I joined my ship, HMS Victorious, the aircraft carrier, in December 1974, and stayed with her until 1946.
But you were, whilst you were actually on board ship, were you still involved in scouting in some way or other?
Well, yes. Well, I was always looking for it. In Ceylon, I was looking for connections ashore. And when I got on the ship, I found there was nothing there. And I found that the ship's padre was an old Cambridge undergraduate at the college I actually worked at in my younger days. And so we struck a relationship there. And I found one or two others, and I encouraged them and myself to form a deep-sea rover crew. So we had a deep-sea rover crew on board the ship. But again, in Australia, at Sydney, I found the headquarters of New South Wales branch, and they had a very good club underneath their main building, which was available to service people to drop in the evening for tea, coffee, and to be picked up by local scouters and either to taken to a meeting or taken home for food and hospitality, and that works very well. And I got mixed up with their national training ground and helped there and took some training whilst we were in the Pacific on a theory basis of studies. And I still keep in touch with one or two of them who have climbed up the ladder in scouting in Australia. So, yes, that carried on right through there.
When you were discharged from the Navy in 46, scouting called you, didn't it, really? Am I using the right word here, calling? Would you regard
it as calling? Well, I went back home, back to my aunts and uncles, and the obvious thing, I was looking where the male scout group was, and they needed a scout leader, and I fell into it, of course. And I did 2 years with them as a leader. And then my district commissioner said, "I've got a job for you, Arthur." He said, "I want to start a group in Trumpington, just outside Cambridge." He said, "Will you go and do that?" So I said yes, and started a pack and then a troop. and eventually found some local leaders. And then he said, I've got another job for you, he said. The Sea Scout troop is falling to pieces and wants a leader, and I know you've been in the Navy. I think that's a job for you. So I moved to the 1st Cambridge to rescue them. And it was really during that period that an advert came into the scouting magazine, which advertised a place for writer purser on the Discovery, Scott's Discovery, which was moored alongside the embankment. And so I applied, and my DC gave me a very nice reference, and I got it.
How much do you know about Scott at that point?
Very little.
You not read about him as a boy?
Well, no, I did very little reading. I wasn't encouraged to read. That was one of the difficulties of my life. And, of course, when I got there, one of my jobs was to show visitors round and talk about Scott and the Antarctic, so there was a lot of quick reading and study on my part.
So would you regard that then as being your first awareness or your first brush of the Antarctic, with the Antarctic?
Oh, yes.
Having to mug up on it.
Yes, from a historical point of view. And, of course, as 1951, which was a Festival of Britain, we did sledging from the ship along the embankment, which attracted great quantities of the public.
I don't know. Tell me about that.
Along with the Times magazine, if they ever wanted a picture, they sent their cameraman down, and we used to put youngsters up in the riggings, and that was a picture they wanted, you know, and it was always there.
Tell me about these huskies on the embankment.
Well, it was not huskies, it was man-horse sledging, yes. We got all the equipment with mutlocks and all that equipment and loaded sledges, and they were hauled along the embankment there to the attraction of masses of the public, of course.
Were you doing this?
No, I didn't do that because my job was on board, because the ship was open to the public, you see, and I was the money man.
So were they... were the people hauling the sledges, were they in Antarctic gear?
Yes, yes. They got it from somewhere, I can't remember where it was now, but whoever was responsible for that displays and that...
And they'd be going up and down the pavement, would they?
Yes, up and down the embankment, yeah.
and the purpose was just to celebrate?
To celebrate, yes, because the ship was dressed overhaul with lights.
Oh, yes. There's an etching there, yeah.
So that was really one of the ship's contributions to the Festival of Britain.
Did the Discovery ever go anywhere at that point? Or was it moored?
No, it was moored moored alongside there. 1937, when the Duke of Gloucester took it. BB accepted it on behalf of the Association.
Can you remember what it was you read to brief yourself on the Scots era?
Well, I suppose the two volumes up here, The Voyage of the Discovery.
Right.
There was a lot of material displayed all around the ship, and you picked it up as you went, and well, you began to live with it, you know. You felt part of it. And then I suppose it was in 1952 when the Association received a letter from the Governor of the Falkland Islands, Sir Miles Clifford, asking the Association to find two leaders for a relief expedition to Antarctica.
Now, do you know why that letter was written? Did they ever find out what spurred it?
No, I don't. I didn't. All I know is that the headquarters had received the letter and they put it into the magazine requesting applications. And I thought, well, as I'm doing this job, I really ought to go and see what it is like firsthand so I can speak with knowledge. And so I wrote off my application And we had an Australian on board, Ian Clark, who was a leftover from the Australian contingent. And like most Australians, they never go straight back home. They wander around Europe and so forth. And eventually he came as a paying guest on Discovery. And he and I grew a friendship while he was there. And he applied also. And he went with me. So we went together. Which was rather nice. And we're still great friends and keep in contact.
What do you remember of that little process, the selection process? Did you have to go for interview, for example?
Yes, I'm. Well, it's a vague one now.
It's a long time ago.
But it's a long time ago. But we obviously went to Scout headquarters in Buckingham Palace Road and sat before a few commissioners there. Obviously, we're asked a number of questions and background, and I suppose my background being a member of staff gave me one foot on the ladder. And Ian, being again an adventurous type and full of enthusiasm, he got a foot on the ladder as well. So we both got selected, and that was it.
So your memory is that you were interviewed by scouting personnel,
not by
government people?
As far as I can remember, that's all there were. As we say, it's a long time ago, and that's a blank piece. The main thing was
But your name
I got a place.
Exactly. Your names are forwarded to Clifford.
Yes. Yes, they would have done that, presumably to Sec Fridge, Frank Elliott. And there we were, ready to go in October, November.
So how much warning did you have between being selected and sailing?
About a couple of months, probably. I mean, Ian was on board, so he had nothing really, only to say, I think, a relative in Bournemouth, he went to say, cheerio, I'm going here. Keep in touch with the family. And then off we went.
Did you have any particular goodbyes to say?
I didn't, no, because I drew a blank. I left Cambridge and I put the shutter down.
Right.
My family, really, were Cambridge people. My grandmother and my grandfather, and there were four brothers. My father and three other sons of the family. Apart from the one I live with, the one who lived in the grandfather's house, and one who lived further up in Cambridge, I very seldom saw. And it was one of those families, there wasn't a good relationship, unfortunately, with the brothers. So obviously I didn't know much. And then grandfather and grandmother died. She died in 94 and was a district nurse, delivering babies almost until the day she passed away. Incredible woman. But that's really the family there. When I left Cambridge, that was it.
So when you were accepted by FIDS, did they give you a clear idea what it was you were going to do down there?
Well, I went down on under the understanding that I was going to do METOBS. Yes, I'd done a bit of METOBS in scouting. And that's what I thought I was going to do.
This is a familiar story, Arthur.
Well, until I got to Stanley, yes. And then my interview with Frank. He said, no, he said, we want you to stay behind while the ship goes south to do some work on ionospherics, which was news to me, of course. So I stayed behind and did some ionospheric work.
So you were being trained at Stanley, yeah?
Yes, to do what was going to be required of me. Which basically was to develop the 40-foot of film, which came out the beast every day, to develop that, dry it, and then analyse the frequencies and get them coded for Jeff Collock to transmit back to Stanley. Basically, that was the routine I was going to do and did throughout the time there. So it was film development and then analysis of the results. But I put my foot down because I said, look, I came to do met work. And eventually he gave way. He said, all right, instead of you doing every 4 hours, he said, we'll halve it. You do every 6 hours. So I did met every 6 hours. And, well, that satisfied me because I did what I thought I was going to do.
What was Stanley like in 1952, 53, wasn't it, when you first arrived? Paint me a little thumbnail sketch.
Well, yes. I mean, FIDs usually got housed, if they were staying behind for a little while, with the Breckens in Fitzroy Road, which was a sort of a large boarding house. And it was Ma Brecken and Jeannie, who was the daughter, a lovely lady. They both were. They were a glorious family, really. They made you feel at home. They fed you well, looked after you, and kept an eye on you. And by and large, that was it, because I suppose in those days, at that Christmas time, really, it was up to the Arnas folk station and then back to be fed. Then it was either writing or reading or... There wasn't much else to do, really, because there was, apart from those that were with us and staying behind, there wasn't time enough, really, to make any commitments to people at that stage. So I was really pleased when the Bisco came back and we went aboard again to go south, because that's really where I wanted to go.
By this time, they'd shown you what to do with the ionospheric machine. And...
Well, they gave me the idea. I mean, basically, they were looking at the reading of the frequencies and how to judge that and so forth. I suppose I must have done a bit of developing there, because I mean I walked into it as soon as we got the machine running, because that was really, it was set up when we were there. And as soon as it was set into motion.
Well, you sailed on the Bisco down to down to Port Lockroy under Captain Johnson.
Yes.
What do you make of
Bill
him?
Johnson, yes.
What do you make of him?
Oh, a character.
In what respect?
Yeah, well, he was a big man. I suppose he was what you call a seagoing captain. I thought he was a delightful character. Yes. Again, we had little to do with him, of course, while we were sailing south. There were 18 of us cramped in a few bunks in the small mess room. And there we whiled our time. But the other character, I suppose, was Chiefy, the engineer. I always recall that we went to Goose Green, and it backed up to the ferry. And rested on the rudder. And they had to knock the rudder pin down. And they weren't doing well, but Chiefy thought he would do better. He took the sledgehammer, took one swipe at it, missed it, and hit his foot. that always remains an incident. Yes, Chiefy.
So Stanley was a bit of a ghost town, was it, would you say, in the 50s?
Well, it was a quiet, I suppose. I would say rather like Fremantle in Australia, which is almost a cowboy town in my day there. I mean, people used to ride in and hitch up their horses, and as they did in Stanley, of course, they used to come in from the camps riding by horse, not as they do today in Land Rovers and motorbikes. And so it was very much it was a community, but a quiet community, going about its daily business. And we were just part of that, doing our bit, like everybody else.
And was the FIDS operation a mere speck in the town, or did it dominate the town?
Well, no, it didn't dominate it. I suppose only when the ship came in and people got kitted out again in the stores alongside the quay there, or you went up to Government House where FIDS office was. They were the two points. And if you were on the ship and not coming ashore, that was it. Mm. If you were coming ashore, as I was for that short space of time, then it was up to Brecon's. And then you walked to and fro. But yes, no, that... It was a place I grew to love. And I would have still been there today. I felt very much at home in the Falklands. But that wasn't a bit. It's another story.
I'll may ask you that, about that towards the end. Let's go back to the chronology, if we may. Mm. It doesn't matter that we dart about a bit. But you got on board the Biscoe, and she was a bit late leaving for Stanley, wasn't she, I gather, like that season? Sorry, leaving for Loughroy.
I suppose she was. It must have been, it was in January, it must have been, I think. Sure. Well,
when you got there, it was a fairly busy period to get it.
Well, we went to Admiralty Islands first to offload there. Then we went to Deception again to offload, and then to Hope Bay, and again to offload. And each base was fascinating. First time in, one's eyes widened, and they were all different, particularly Deception, going through the narrows there. And Hope Bay was that climb up, I can still remember it. And that's where I really learnt to judge the size of packing cases. You knew how to look for a pack of cornflakes, which were large but light. Yes, you got to know your cargo quite quickly.
Because you hadn't spent many years yearning to go to the Antarctic, it kind of came upon you suddenly. Maybe you didn't have that many expectations, but did the Antarctic strike you as being as you imagined it, or what were your first impressions of suddenly coming across the Antarctic Peninsula?
Well, from the photographs and the logs and things on Discovery, I had a picture of what it was like. Now I was seeing it in reality, the beautiful blues and the ice and the bergs. And here they were, alive. They weren't pictures anymore. They were real things. And then when wildlife came, and you actually saw a whale, this huge, great lump of whale, or seals, or penguins, here they were. My goodness, how delightful it really was. Yes. And that's, I suppose, Hope Bay was the first time I really came into contact with huskies, because they used them to drag up the supplies as well. That was great. But then we weren't there long. As soon as we finished, we were off down to LaCroix.
The huts you were visiting were probably not that much more evolved from the ones that Scott had been using, I guess. Did that strike you?
Well, yes, I suppose there were. I don't actually recall a great deal of actually spending time in the huts. Mm. We saw them from the outside, but the task was offloading, carrying stores and doing the things that one had to do in there, and then back for meal on board. And I suppose it wasn't until you got to Port LaCroix that actually... here was a base. Yes, that's right. You could see it then, couldn't you? The hut, of which, of course, we enlarged during the summer period while the ship went further south and Ralph Linton helped us put the other extension on. But yes, it was that feeling, but perhaps not quite as primitive as Scott would have had, when you see all the equipment stowed all around them. Well, that was not so in our case. Anyway.
Walk me through the door. What would I see if I went through the door at Port Lockroy in that season that you were there?
Yes, it was a hallway, and then divided up. To the right, you went to the engine shed, and just a little to the left, you went to the galley, and then the living room. And then a bit further on was the bedroom. And the bit, which was that bit, which is the bit we were going to build on. And there was some rebuilding from the bedroom to the galley to take the beast, the ionospheric beast.
Which you brought with you in kit form.
Yeah, that's right, yes. And Steve Ward, who was the base leader, and Fred Bird, who was the other ionospheric person. That's where they spent their early days very busily putting this thing together. And I suppose I was helping, or I was doing my Met Obs as well. So, yes, things got there. But that was it. And the base grew, of course. As soon as we put the other bit on, the Radio Shack got in one corner, and I got in the other corner with the Met and my decoding of the frequencies. And that became sort of the workshop, as it were. But yes.
What was it like to... I mean, the Beastie was in bits when she arrived. Is that correct?
In crates, yes. Yeah. So it must have been in crates.
So were you involved or did you observe?
Not really, no. Yeah. Only doing the things that I was asked to do. I mean, that was beyond me in my days. I mean, a new world.
Well, there were problems, though, weren't there, with getting it going?
I think so, yes. I think there were words passing to and fro between Steve and Jeff and Fred. But, I mean, they sorted them out. It was time and error. I mean, they knew what they were doing. At least I was sure they knew what they were doing. And they got on to it. And I suppose I then got on to preparing the dark room, ready to receive the first load of film that came out.
Were there any techniques you had to use for developing an extraordinarily long roll of film, 40 metres?
It was like I suppose you'd call it a 40-gallon drum cut in half, so it was like a bath. And this winding thing, so you wrapped the film round and you turned it, so it was going up and down, round and round, until you got to the stage where you could see the prints there. Then you washed it and fixed it, as it were, and then dried it. And as soon as it was dried, you cut it off in bits and you began to decode it.
And the practicalities of all that, what would you do with the old chemicals, or would you reuse and reuse and reuse?
Yes, they were reused for a time until they got weak, and then you mixed up another lot.
And what happened to the old chemical?
Well, they went out onto the ice. That's like everything else did in those days. You didn't bring it home with you.
So it was put in a drum, was it, and put on the ice?
Yes, it was carted out and put on the ice along with the other rubbish.
And drying can't have been that easy.
Well, the hut was never... I mean, it was warm. And paper dries in warm. Whether it was a different type of paper that didn't take long to dry, but it dried reasonably crisp. I don't know whether I've got a bit there or not, but you've probably seen it anywhere. By the end of the day... because I used to develop in the morning, and by evening time it was dry, and probably then I would cut it and work on it in the evening and finish it the following day to get off the results.
Can you, in layman's language, describe the process of converting this photograph into Morse code information?
There was a... yes. I measured the frequencies and by coding, and I can't remember the codes now. Right, they're past gone me now. Once I got the codes there, all I did was pass it to Jeff, who then morsed it to Stanley.
So you're just simply reading the frequencies on the film?
Yes.
Writing them down. And then converting them into Morse code.
That's right. He did that, yes. I gave him
The figures,
and he just did it from there.
And who was at the other end? Who was receiving all this information?
Well, somebody in Stanley, presumably the wireless station in Stanley, and then I think they moved it on then to South Africa, which was, I think, the collecting station from various parts around the world.
And was it ever explained to you why this information was so important?
Only it was to do with shortwave radio. And critical frequencies for certain frequencies for transmission and so forth. But it was something I never really got terribly involved with, except doing the bit that I knew I had to do, and I did it, and I did it. I enjoyed it, doing it. But then you never know these things, do you? How what you contribute means further along the line. Mm. It's a piece of a jigsaw into a whole picture. But yes, that was enjoyable.
The other work you were doing was this Met Observations, as you mentioned before.
Yes.
Tell me a bit about that, if you wouldn't mind.
Yes, well, every 6, 12, 6 and midnight... I would climb up to the Stevenson screen to take the temperature readings up there, the barograph reading. And I had a wind speed dial down in the office along with a barometer. And I collected all that, observed the cloud formation, etc. And then wrote up again the report for Jeff to... transmit to Stanley, and I did that every 4 hours. You know,
were you getting any surprising results, or was it all routine?
Well, it was routine. The weather changed, obviously. During the winter, you had to get yourself out the front door. And channel yourself so you could get up to the Stevenson screen, which was behind the hut, and that was quite risky at times in a gale. And I remember several times actually going out in very strong winds with an ice axe in my hand, and once or twice I got rocketed and caught hold with my ice axe and managed to get up to the screen and do what I had to do. Reset the thermometers and then back again.
So the ice axe was a kind of an anchor against the wind.
Oh, absolutely, yes, yeah. Very much so. And then on other nights, of course, you'd go there on a beautiful moonlight night, and the splendour of the surrounds, the mountains, and the ice in moonlight was absolutely terrific. And the corona, which you got one or two pictures of that, there was on one occasion, and I often say this was one of the times I felt my nearest to my maker, because it was, it was a corona, but it was as if Christ was there with his arms out. And that stood in my memory, and I just stood there watching this for some time, and then I... Oh, my goodness, how splendid.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, there was this, the arc there, and the colours of beautiful colours of reds and yellows and blues. And the light that's reflected from it appeared to be to this outstretched arms. It must have been a reflection from one part of the optical phenomena that was causing it. But there it was. And it was the only time I ever saw that. But it remains as a very definite memory to me of the stillness of the Antarctic itself.
One of it said to me that if God had chosen to dwell on Earth, he would be in the Antarctic.
He would certainly have had his peace there. He'd had time to meditate.
In the log, the 1953 log at Port Lockwright, we've got copies here, you've done some fantastic sketches of the solar halos and the parhelias and mock suns as well. There's a brilliant piece of sketching with what I presume are colour pencils.
Yes.
Arthur. And just talk me through this one, because this is a complete circle around the sun with two phantom suns.
Yes, I suppose, you see, it was when you look at this bit, these sort of arc that came out there, it could be as if they were actually turned the other way. But
this one here has the sun in the centre of a circle of lights.
Yes.
And then at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock on the circle of light around the sun, there appear to be secondary images of the sun. What you call, in the dog, you call them phantom suns.
They could be. I mean, I drew, as I saw it, with the amazement of what I saw. It was quite fantastic. I mean, I'd never seen it before, and the first time you see these things, you become overwhelmed. Rainbows, yes, but this was something quite different, quite different. Quite phenomenal. Yes.
Did anybody ever explain, or did he ever understand how it happened?
No. No. I suppose it was a part. There was nobody else really on base at that time to share it with that were probably interested, because they had their work to do and their concentration was within the ionospheric work. And I suppose it was then just a piece of the daily routine. You wrote, you drew, and recorded what you saw.
So you still don't understand why this image appeared?
No, I don't. No.
Only in the Antarctic?
Well, yes, I mean, I suppose people would say it was a form of ice crystals being captured by something. Must have been the rays of the moon, mustn't it? I mean, that's probably the moon or reddish moon. I mean, it couldn't have been the sun, because the sun wasn't there, was it? So it must have been the moon, and the moon reflecting itself on ice crystals or particles that were suspended in the atmosphere above.
So these are both images taken at night?
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
At one point you talk about how you would like to have seen these images from a different angle, different location, but that you didn't have any camping gear or the gear to get away.
Well, yes, we were certainly a static base, but we did have a manhole sledge on base, and we did have bits and pieces like skis and ski sticks, and Robbie, the diesel electrical mechanic, set about building an igloo on base, and he was quite successful with it. So successful, he cut himself in and spent a night in there, and it worked. So three of us decided we should do an expedition. And I was particularly interested in the Sierra de Fife range, the gap between there, because it was in there that Lieutenant Commander Marr and his party had a near miss with an avalanche. And as it was a part of the early history, and he had a scouting connection as well, I thought, I must go and have a look up here. And so the three of us, Jeff, Fred and I, we were the three that did it, and we left Steve and Robbie on base. Steve, fortunately, was also a radio man, so he could operate the radio. And he could take one or two of the readings for me on the screen, and I did the rest. He knew what to follow. So I did work up when we were up on the top of the ice shelf, and we transmitted that back, and that was sent off. Nobody, of course, knew we were out. So we spent, yes, we climbed up this 100-foot high ice cliff onto the glacier and started to haul away. But it was very, very hard going. We kept sinking. But we persevered hauling this sledge. And we got firmer still, and we moved on a bit further. And then we thought, well, we must do something about building this igloo for the night. And so we set work on this. We got two layers round the igloo, and the third section wouldn't hold. It crumbled. And it obviously wasn't going to build the igloo.
He had no igloo building training. This is all done.
Well, no, Robbie did this on base and it held.
But he was learning as he went, was he?
Absolutely. Mm. So we thought quickly, what am we going to do? So we thought, yes, we'll dig a hole. So we dug out the hole. And with our skis, our sledges and sticks, we laid on top and put the ice blocks on top. And then cut a tunnel and crawled in and spent the night there. I cooked inside while they did their bits and pieces. And there we spent the night. And the following day, we wandered around a bit and then made back to base.
This was a lie-over, was it? Because of
yes, it was a night out, as it were.
Mm.
We knew we shouldn't have gone, but nobody knew.
It was an illicit night out.
Oh, it was an illicit night out, yes.
Was there any comeback?
No, I'm not quite sure how that, whether it got out or not. I mean, it must have got out. I think somebody got a little bit of rocket for it, but we enjoyed it. We set out to achieve something, and we did.
One of the problems with that was the fact your boots were freezing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's the old stove, the old Bunsen, the old cooking stove in there, boiling up and pemmican hash, certainly caused a fug, but by golly, in the morning, things were stiff to get going. I suppose we were quite lucky, really. No one can visualise what might have happened. It's just going to happen, whatever happened. But we felt fairly confident, you know, it was going to be all right, as one must do. Anyway, we dug out eventually, and there it was, beautiful day.
So the hole was an essential shelter for the night, if
absolutely.
It wasn't just Boy Scouting, it was life and death.
Well, yes, it was, yes. Well, what do you do if you can't build an igloo? One had heard about ice caves. People dug in and got inside to take shelter. So all you've got to do really is to find a wall around you and a roof over your head. And that was it, the dugout.
You were searching for a safe route through the mountains, weren't you, between Wall Mountain and Sierra de Fife?
Sierra de Fife, yeah.
Yeah. What was that about? What were you trying to achieve?
Well, I was really trying to look at the sort of area which Marr travelled. But the time actually didn't allow it. I mean, we were due back, and we had to get back to base again. But at least we were up there, and we were close to it. And it was different from looking at it at base. You were actually on the glacier, and there it was, that gap, and the mountain range there where that must have been an avalanche through there.
You did other trips on skis as well. That was a whole man-hauling sledge trip.
No, the only skiing that we did was exercise, really. I mean, La Croix is, as you know, is an outcrop of rock, and then it's frozen over when winter comes. And there was really nothing that one can do close by for that, really. But we were able to do some ski practice, which was interesting if you'd never skied before, as most of us hadn't. And some of us spent most of our time with our head down and our skis up rather than standing upright. But in time, we mastered it and enjoyed it. And it was a form of exercise, which was necessary to relieve the boredom of the daily routine.
I'm impressed by the artwork on these pictures of the meteorological images you saw, and I wonder whether artist artwork was something you were pursuing before or after. Did you continue with it?
No. I suppose there's a bit of a connection. This district commissioner I talked to you about, who was very helpful to me in many ways and sent me lots of challenges. But he worked as an assistant librarian at the university library. And I admired his writing. He had a script. Mm. And I said to him one day, "I've always admired your writing." He said, "Yes," he said, "Arthur, if you came to work with us at the university library, your first day," he said, "we would give you a card and said, this is now how you will write if you wish to work with us." And I thought, well, there's a challenge, isn't there? So I suppose eventually I began to look to pen and ink. And over the years, I began to develop that. I never realised to the point I really wanted to go. I never reached that point. But I still do. I do all the baptism registers and things in the church. I'm known as the parish clerk. So it kept me going. And that's really that letter from the district commissioner. Mm. It admired it. And really that. I suppose it's one thing I've said to myself, when you retire, Arthur, you must take up pen and ink. It is something I really want to do when I find time to retire.
So these drawings are pen and ink with colour pencil?
That's right, yes.
On top, yeah.
Yes.
And they really are very spectacular images of the sun or the moon doing remarkable things in the atmosphere of the Antarctic.
Yes.
Partly because, of course, the atmosphere is so clear down there, normally.
Absolutely, yes.
The ionosonde machine, the automatic one that you installed, had to be operating 24 hours a day.
That's right. 5 minutes to the hour, it clicked on, and then it did its five-minute sweep, clicked off, and then it went round until it came to 5 minutes to the hour again, clicked on. So every hour, 5 minutes to the hour, as it were, it clicked on, recorded what was going on in the ionosphere, and recorded it on this piece of film.
Was there a booming noise attached to this as well?
It was a hum, yes. Hmm. But I can remember it was a hum because it was in a room of its own.
And of course, there had to be a generator running all the time as well.
Indeed, there were four generators, to my remembering, one which was running all the time. One which was standby, one which was, there'd be two. One was running, one would take over from the one that was running while the other one sort of cooled down and got maintenance work on it. One in bits, as it were, being really overhauled, and a spare one. But they were going 24 hours a day. Really were.
So there was no escape from the noise?
No, but strangely enough, it wasn't terrific. It was a gentle hum going all the time. It was in his own apartment. There was a door there. But I suppose one was conscious of it, like a train. If you live alongside the railway, you don't notice it, do you? Mm. And I think that was the same with the generator. It was there, but it was part of living, part of the atmosphere of the base. It was a part of the hum of the day.
Building an igloo, of course, meant you could escape from it, I suppose, especially away from base.
Yeah, it was a warm one. It was the warmest place in the hut, but none of it was cold because there was radiator and the anthracite stove in the living room. But yes, no, it was, and of course the galley was anthracite as well. The stove kept a lot of water, a lot of warmth going.
What's of your Boy Scout attributes that you find most useful? In the Antarctic?
Yes, yes. When we arrived, we got on the first day, Steve said to me, he said, I believe you were a scout. So I said, yes, I was. He said, well, you know, you must know something about first aid. So I said, well, I got my ambulance badge. Oh, he said, you're our medical officer. And he said, there's your medical box there, with a chest sitting on the floor there. So I thought, oh, yeah. So later on in the day, I thought I'd better have a look and see what was in there. So I opened the lid, and on the first tray were a set of surgical instruments. Whew, I thought. I took that out. On the second tray was a set of dental instruments. Anyway, eventually we got to bandages at the bottom. And I thought, my goodness, I hope I don't have to use these.
Did you have any call to be a doctor?
Yeah, well, yes, I did. But I didn't use... I didn't, apart from odd cuts and things, stickers and bandages and things, I didn't use anything else. But I had two other pieces of equipment which weren't in there. One was a blow lamp. And that was because somebody got his John Thomas stuck to the Latin bucket, and I had to free it from the bucket.
How did you do that?
Well, it was just gently warming the sides of where he's sat out there with his legs apart, and got you warm the metal of there until eventually it eased. And the second one was... Steve got trouble with his back passage, and he said, you better have a look at this. It looked a bit red to me, so I said, I don't know what that is. So we got in touch with Hope Bay, where it had the doctor, and I said, we've got trouble here. He said, well, you better have a closer look, he said. And that's where the inspection lamp came into being. So I was able to use the inspection lamp to find the symptoms of what the trouble was. And then he told me what to do. But that was interesting, yes. That was my first aid badge. And my cook's badge, of course, yes.
And other Boy Scout attributes, such as not swiping, lighting fires with two sticks?
Well, yes. I mean, lots of things there, communications, in a way. They were the whole background of Theos. I mean, is about living as a patrol. In fact, here was a group of five men. Here was a patrol of scouts, with a patrol leader, the base leader, and everybody had a specific role, and one interchanged roles because one did cooking one week, and other chores another week, fetching the stores, the anthracite, etc. And so you move around. And there was the routine, the cleanliness of the base, which is terribly important, and always is. If you want to be healthy, you've got to have a healthy environment. And so that was a part, again, of the week routine, the scrub-out day, which was a bartering day in many respects. People didn't like scrubbing or doing odd chores. And so if you were prepared to do it, you could barter for it.
How do you mean?
I enjoyed chocolate, you see. I didn't smoke, so people could do things and they would have my sort of ration of cigarettes. And so we got through life that way. And it was a happy band of five people, really.
Tell me a bit about them, the five of them. Was it Stephen Ward who was a bass leader?
Yes. Steve was in the acting business, as far as I can recall. I believe he was a married man. We never spoke about his wife, or he never spoke about the stage either. But he was a tall man, very firm. I think a good leader. He kept us, you know, together. Yes, I like Steve. Dickie Bird, a short man. Again, what I call a chubby fella, really. Happy. I can almost see him as a bosun of a ship somewhere, you know, that sort of well-built man there. Then Jeff Collum, the wireless operator, with a great ginger beard, who didn't seem to be nothing but except at the keyboard or twiddling around in there. And he lived on the radio all day long, except for the cat, which slept above him on one of the transmitters. and that was Jeff. And Robbie, who spent most of his time in and out of the engine room, who was a great lover of classical music. And we took records down with us from Stanley because he was doing his second year. And he was very fond of Mendelssohn. And we had Mendelssohn's clarinet concerto not once, twice, but sometimes three or four times a day. So by the end of the bass, you could almost hum that concerto. But even if you didn't like it, you got caught with it. And I did like it, of course, because I was very fond of that type of music. So, yes. And as a fivesome, I can only remember on one occasion that somebody got upset somewhere and went out and slammed the door. And I think we looked at each other and thought, what? Anyway, we did nothing. 3 hours later, he came back, and that was it. Forgotten.
let's take a break. We have lots more still to talk about after, yes. But let's take a break. Thank you.